Side 19. The Bachman Books, four early novels. Continuing with The Running Man, on page 584. I'm being bracketed, he thought. The idea brought a helpless rabbit terror. No, his mind corrected. You've already been bracketed. Minus 070 and counting. Richards walked rapidly to the bathroom, being calm, ignoring his terror the way a man on a high ledge ignores the drop. If he was going to get out of this, it would be by keeping his head. If he panicked, he would die quickly. Someone was in the shower, singing a popular song in a cracked and pitchless voice. No one was at the urinals or the washstands. The trick had popped effortlessly into his mind as he had stood by the window, watching them gather in their offhand, sinister way. If it hadn't occurred to him, he thought he would be there yet, like Aladdin watching smoke from the lamp coalesce into an omnipotent djinn. They had used the trick as boys to steal newspapers from development basements. Mole bought them, 2 cents a pound. He took one of the wire toothbrush holders off the wall with a hard snap of his wrist. It was a little rusted, but that wouldn't matter. He walked down to the elevator, bending the toothbrush holder out straight. He pushed the call button, and the cage took a slow eternity to come down from 8. It was empty. Thank Christ it was empty. He stepped in, looked briefly down the halls, and then turned to the control panel. There was a key slot beside the button marked for the basement. The janitor would have a special card to shove in there. An electric eye scanned the card, and then the janitor could push the button and ride down to the basement. What if it doesn't work? Never mind that now. Grimacing in anticipation of a possible electric shock, Richard jammed the toothbrush wire into the slot and pushed the basement button simultaneously. There was a noise from inside the control panel that sounded like a brief electronic curse. There was a light tingling jolt up his arm. For a moment, nothing else. Then the folding brass gate slid across, the doors closed, and the elevator lurched unhappily downward. A small tendril of blue smoke curled out of the slot in the panel. Richards stood away from the elevator door and watched the numbers flash backwards. When the L lit, the motor high above made a grinding sound, and the car seemed about to stop. Then after a moment, perhaps after it thought it had scared Richards enough, it descended again. 20 seconds later, the doors slid open, and Richard stepped out into the huge, dim basement. There was water dripping somewhere, and the scurry of a disturbed rat, but otherwise the basement was his. For now. Minus 069 and counting. Huge, rusted heating pipes, festooned with cobwebs, crawled crazily all over the ceiling. When the furnace kicked on suddenly, Richard's almost screamed in terror. The surge of adrenaline to his limbs and heart was painful, for a moment almost incapacitating. There were newspapers here, too, Richard saw, thousands of them, stacked up and tied with string. The rat had nested in them by the thousands. Whole families stared out at the interloper with ruby, distrustful eyes. He began to walk away from the elevator, pausing halfway across the cracked cement floor. There was a large fuse box bolted to a supporting post, and behind it, leaning against the other side, a litter of tools. Richards took the crowbar and continued to walk, keeping his eyes on the floor. Near the far wall, he spied the main storm drain to his left. He walked over and looked at it, wondering in the back of his mind if they knew he was down here yet. The storm drain was constructed of vented steel. It was about 3 feet across. And on the far side, there was a slot for the crowbar. Richard slipped it in, levered up the cover, and then put one foot on the crowbar to hold it. He got his hands under the lip of the cover and pushed it over. It fell to the cement with a clang that made the rats squeak with dismay. The pipe beneath slanted down at a 45-degree angle, and Richards guessed that its bore could be no more than 2.5 feet. It was very dark. Claustrophobia suddenly filled his mouth with flannel. Too small to maneuver in, almost too small to breathe in, but it had to be. He turned the storm drain cover back over and edged it toward the pipe entrance just enough so he could grip it from beneath once he was down there. Then he walked over to the fuse box, hammered the padlock off with the crowbar, and shoved it open. He was about to begin pulling fuses when another idea occurred to him. He walked over to the newspapers, which lay in dirty yellow drifts against the whole eastern length of the cellar. Then he ferreted out the folded and dog-eared book of matches he had been lighting his smokes with. There were three left. He yanked out a sheet of paper and formed it into a stilt, held it under his arm like a dunce cap, and lit a match. The first one guttered out in a draft. The second fell out of his trembling hand and hissed out on the damp concrete. The third stayed alight. He held it to his paper spill, and yellow flame bloomed. A rat, perhaps sensing what was to come, ran across his foot and into the darkness. A terrible sense of urgency filled him now, and yet he waited until the spill was flaming a foot high. He had no more matches. Carefully, he tucked it into a fissure in the chest-high paper wall and waited until he saw that the fire was spreading. The huge oil tank, which serviced the Y, was built into the adjoining wall. Perhaps it would blow. Richards thought it would. Trotting now, he went back to the fuse box and began ripping out the long tubular fuses. He got most of them before the basement lights went out. He felt his way across to the storm drain, aided by the growing, flickering light of the burning papers. He sat down with his feet dangling and then slowly eased in. When his head was below the level of the floor, he pressed his knees against the sides of the pipe to hold himself steady, and worked his arms up above his head. It was slow work. There was very little room to move. The light of the fire was brilliant yellow now, and the crackling sound of burning filled his ears. Then his groping fingers found the lip of the drain, and he slid them up until they gripped the vented cover. He yanked it forward slowly, supporting more and more of the weight with the muscles of his back and neck. When he judged that the far edge of the cover was on the edge of dropping into place, he gave one last fierce tug. The cover dropped into place with a clang, bending both wrists back cruelly. Richards let his knees relax, and he slid downward like a boy shooting the chutes. The pipe was coated with slime, and he slid effortlessly about 12 feet to where the pipe elbow bent into a straight line. His feet struck smartly, and he stood there like a drunk leaning against the lamppost. But he couldn't get into the horizontal pipe. The elbow bend was too sharp. The taste of the claustrophobia became huge, gagging. Trapped, his mind babbled. Trapped in here, trapped, trapped. A steel scream rose in his throat, and he choked it down. Calm down. Sure, it's very hackneyed, very trite, but we must be very calm down here. Very calm, because we are at the bottom of this pipe, and we can't get up, and we can't get down, and if the fucking oil tank goes boom, we are going to be fricasseed very neatly, and... Slowly, he began to wriggle around until his chest was against the pipe instead of his back. The slime coating acted as a lubricant, helping his movement. It was very bright in the pipe now and getting warmer. The vented cover threw prison bar shadows on his struggling face. Once leaning against his chest and belly and groin with his knees bending the right way, he could slip down further, letting his calves and feet slide into the horizontal pipe until he was in the praying position. Still no good. His buttocks were pushing against the solid ceramic facing above the entrance to the horizontal pipe. Faintly, it seemed that he could hear shouted commands above the heavy crackle of the fire, but it might have been his imagination, which was now strained and fevered beyond the point of trust. He began to flex the muscles of his thighs and calves in a tiring seesaw rhythm, and little by little his knees began to slide out from under him. He worked his hands up over his head again to give himself more room, and now his face lay solidly against the slime of the pipe. He was very close to fitting now. He swayed his back as much as he could and began to push with his arms and head, the only things left in any position to give him leverage. When he had begun to think there was not enough room, that he was going to simply hang here, unable to move either way, his hips and buttocks suddenly popped through the horizontal pipe's opening like a champagne cork from a tight bottleneck. The small of his back scraped excruciatingly as his knees slid out from under him, and his shirt rucked up to his shoulder blades. Then he was in the horizontal pipe, except for his head and arms, which were bent back at a joint-twisting angle. He wriggled the rest of the way in and then paused there, panting, his face streaked with slime and rat droppings, the skin of his lower back abraded and oozing blood. This pipe was narrower still. His shoulders scraped lightly on both sides each time his chest rose in respiration. Thank God I'm underfed. Panting, he began to back into the unknown darkness of the pipe. minus 068, and counting. He made slow, mole-like progress for about 50 yards through the horizontal pipe, backing up blindly. Then the oil tank in the Y's basement suddenly blew with a roar that set up enough sympathetic vibrations in the pipes to nearly rupture his eardrums. There was a yellow-white flash, as if a pile of phosphorus had ignited. It faded to a rosy, shifting glow. A few moments later, a blast of thermal air struck him in the face, making him grin painfully. The tape camera in his jacket pocket swung and bounced as he tried to back up faster. The pipe was picking up heat from the fierce explosion and fire that was raging somewhere above him, the way the handle of a skillet picks up heat from a gas ring. Richards had no urge to be baked down here like a potato in a Dutch oven. Sweat rolled down his face, mixing with the black streaks of ordure already there, making him look in the waxing and waning glow of the reflected fire like an Indian painted for war. The sides of the pipe were hot to the touch now. Lobster-like, Richards humped backwards on his knees and forearms, his buttocks rising to smack the top of the pipe at every movement. His breath came in sharp, dog-like gasps. The air was hot, full of the slick taste of oil, uncomfortable to breathe. A headache surfaced within his skull and began to push daggers into the backs of his eyes. I'm going to fry in here. I'm going to fry. Then his feet were suddenly dangling in the air. Richards tried to peer through his legs and see what was there, but it was too dark behind, and his eyes were too dazzled by the light in front. He would have to take his chance. He backed up until his knees were on the edge of the pipe's ending, and then slid them cautiously over. His shoes were suddenly in water, cold and shocking after the heat of the pipe. The new pipe ran at right angles to the one Richards had just come through, and it was much larger, big enough to stand in bent over. The thick, slowly moving water came up over his ankles. He paused for just a moment to stare back into the tiny pipe with its soft circle of reflected fire glow. The fact that he could see any glow at all from this distance meant that it must have been a very big bang indeed. Richards reluctantly forced himself to know it would be their job to assume him alive rather than dead in the inferno of the YMCA basement, but perhaps they would not discover the way he had taken until the fire was under control. That seemed a safe assumption, but it had seemed safe to assume that they could not trace him to Boston, too. Maybe they didn't. After all, what did you really see? No, it had been them. He knew it. The hunters. They had even carried the odor of evil. It had wafted up to his fifth-floor room on invisible psychic thermals. A rat dog paddled past him, pausing to look up briefly with glittering eyes. Richard splashed clumsily off after it, in the direction the water was flowing. Minus 067, and counting. Richard stood by the ladder, looking up, dumbfounded by the light. No regular traffic, which was something, but light. The light was surprising because it had seemed that he had been walking in the sewers for hours, piled upon hours. In the darkness, with no visual input and no sound but the gurgle of water, the occasional soft splash of a rat, and the ghostly thumpings in other pipes. What happens if someone flushes a John over my head? Richards wondered morbidly. His time sense had been utterly destroyed. Now, looking up at the manhole cover some 15 feet above him, he saw that the light had not yet faded out of the day. There were several circular breather holes in the cover, and pencil-sized rays of light pressed coins of sun on his chest and shoulders. No air cars had passed over the cover since he had gotten here, only an occasional heavy ground vehicle and a fleet of Honda cycles. It made him suspect that, more by good luck and the law of averages than by inner sense of direction, he had managed to find his way to the core of the city, to his own people. Still, he didn't dare go up until dark. To pass the time, he took out the tape camera, popped in a clip, and began recording his chest. He knew the tapes were fast light, able to take advantage of the least available light, and he did not want to give away too much of his surroundings. He did no talking or capering this time. He was too tired. When the tape was done, he put it with the other exposed clip. He wished he could rid himself of the nagging suspicion, almost a certainty, that the tapes were pinpointing him. There had to be a way to beat that. Had to. He sat down stolidly on the third rung of the ladder to wait for dark. He had been running for nearly 30 hours. Minus 066 and counting. The boy, 7 years old, black, smoking a cigarette, leaned closer to the mouth of the alley watching the street. There had been a sudden slight movement in the street where there had been none before. Shadows moved, rested, moved again. The manhole cover was rising. It paused, and something, eyes, glimmered. The cover suddenly slid aside with a clang. Someone, or something, the boy thought with a trace of fear, was moving out there. Maybe the devil was coming out of hell to get Cassie, he thought. Ma said Cassie was going to heaven to be with Dickie and the other angels. The boy thought that was bullshit. Everybody went to hell when they died, and the devil jabbed them in the ass with a pitchfork. He had seen a picture of the devil in the books Bradley had snuck out of the Boston Public Library. Heaven was for push freaks. The devil was the man. It could be the devil, he thought, as Richard suddenly boosted himself out of the manhole and leaned for a second on the seamed and split cement to get his breath back. No tail and no horns, not red like in that book, but the mother looked crazy and mean enough. Now he was pushing the cover back, and now, holy Jesus, he was running toward the alley. The boy grunted, tried to run, and fell over his own feet. He was trying to get up, scrambling and dropping things, and the devil suddenly grabbed him. "Don't stick me with it!" he screamed in a throat-closed whisper. "Don't stick me with no fork, you sumbitch! Shh! Shut up! Shut up!" The devil shook him, making his teeth rattle like marbles in his head, and the boy shut up. The devil peered around in an ecstasy of apprehension. The expression on his face was almost farcical in its extreme fear. The boy was reminded of the comical fellows on that game show, Swim the Crocodiles. He would have laughed if he hadn't been so frightened himself. "You ain't the devil," the boy said. "You'll think I am if you yell." "I ain't gonna," the boy said contemptuously. "What do you think, I want to get my balls cut off? Jesus, I ain't even big enough to come yet." "You know a quiet place we can go?" "Don't kill me, man. I ain't got nothing." The boy's eyes, white in the darkness, rolled up at him. "I'm not going to kill you." Holding his hand, the boy led Richards down the twisting, littered alley and into another. At the end, just before the alley opened onto an air shaft between two faceless high-rise buildings, the boy led him into a lean-to built of scrounged boards and bricks. It was built for 4 feet, and Richards banged his head going in. The boy pulled a dirty swatch of black cloth across the opening and fiddled with something. A moment later, a weak glow lit their faces. The boy had hooked a small light bulb to an old cracked car battery. "I kifed that battery myself," the boy said. "Bradley told me how to fix it up. He's got books. I got a nickel bag, too. I'll give it to you if you don't kill me." "You better not. Bradley's in the stabbers. You kill me and he'll make you shit in your boot and eat it." "I'm not doing any killings," Richard said impatiently. "At least not little kids." "I ain't no little kid. I cut that fucking battery myself." The look of injury forced a dented grin to Richard's face. "All right, what's your name, kid?" "Ain't no kid." Then, sulkily, "Stacy." "Okay, Stacy. Good. I'm on the run. You believe that?" "Yeah, you on the run. You didn't come out of that manhole to buy dirty postcards." He stared speculatively at Richards. "You a honky? Kind of hard to tell with all that dirt." "Stacy, I..." He broke off and ran a hand through his hair. When he spoke again, he seemed to be talking to himself. "I got to trust somebody, and it turns out to be a kid. A kid. Hot Jesus, you ain't even 6, boy."
"I'm 8 in March,"
the boy said angrily.
"My sister Cassie's got cancer," he added. "She screams a lot. That's why I like it here. Kiked that fucking battery myself. You want a toe cup, mister?"
"No, and you don't either. You want $2, Stacy?"
"Christ, yes."
Distress slid over his eyes.
"You didn't come out of no manhole with $2. That's bullshit."
Richards produced a new dollar and gave it to the boy. He stared at it with awe that was close to horror. "There's another one if you bring your brother," Richard said, and seeing his expression, added swiftly, "I'll give it to you on the side so he won't see it. Bring him alone."
"Won't do no good to try and kill Bradley, man. He'll make you shit in your boot."
"And eat it, I know. You run and get him. Wait until he's alone."
$3.
"No."
"Listen, man, for $3 I can get Cassie some stuff at the drug. Then she won't scream so fucking much."
The man's face suddenly worked as if someone the boy couldn't see had punched him. "All right, 3.
"New dollars,"
the boy persisted.
"Yes, for Christ's sake, yes. Get him. And if you bring the cops, you won't get anything."
The boy paused, half in and half out of his little cubbyhole.
"You stupid if you think I do that. I hate them fucking oinkers worse than anyone's, even the devil."
He left, a 7-year-old boy with Richards's life in his grubby, scabbed hands. Richards was too tired to be really afraid. He turned off the light, leaned back, and dozed off. -065. and counting. Dreaming sleep had just begun when his tight-strung senses ripped him back to wakefulness. Confused, in a dark place, the beginning of the nightmare held him for a moment, and he thought that some huge police dog was coming for him, a terrifying organic weapon 7 feet high. He almost cried aloud before Stacy made the real world fall into place by hissing, "If he broke my frickin' light, I'm gonna..." The boy was violently shushed. The cloth across the entrance rippled, and Richards turned on the light. He was looking at Stacy and another black. The new fellow was maybe 18, Richards guessed, wearing a cycle jacket, looking at Richards with a mixture of hate and interest. A switchblade clicked out and glittered in Bradley's hand.
"If you're healed, drop it down."
"I'm not."
"I don't believe that sh—"
He broke off and his eyes widened.
"Hey, you're that guy on the freebie. You offed the YMCA on Huntington Avenue."
The lowering blackness of his face was split by an involuntary grin.
"They said you fried 5 cops. That probably means 15. "He come out of the manhole," Stacy said importantly. "I knew it wasn't the devil right away. I knew it was some honky sumbitch. You gonna cut him, Bradley?"
"Just shut up and let men talk."
Bradley came the rest of the way inside, squatting awkwardly, and sat across from Richards on a splintery orange crate. He looked at the blade in his hand, seemed surprised to see it still there, and closed it up.
"You're hotter than the sun, man,"
he said finally. "That's true."
"Where are you gonna get to?"
"I don't know. I've got to get out of Boston." Bradley sat in silent thought.
"You got to come home with me and Stacy. We got to talk, and we can't do it here. Too open."
"All right," Richard said wearily. "I don't care."
"We go the back way. The pigs are cruising tonight. Now I know why."
When Bradley led the way out, Stacy kicked Richard sharply in the shin. For a moment, Richard stared at him, not understanding, and then remembered. He slipped the boy $3 new, and Stacy made it disappear. -064 and counting. The woman was very old. Richards thought he had never seen anyone as old. She was wearing a cotton print house dress with a large rip under one arm. An ancient, wrinkled dug swayed back and forth against the rip as she went about making the meal that Richards's new dollars had purchased. The nicotine-yellowed fingers diced and pared and peeled. Her feet, splayed into grotesque boat shapes by years of standing, were clad in pink terrycloth slippers. Her hair looked as if it might have been self-waved by an iron held in a trembling hand. It was pushed back into a kind of pyramid by the twisted hairnet which had gone askew at the back of her head. Her face was a delta of time, no longer brown or black, but grayish, stitched with a radiating galaxy of wrinkles, pouches, and sags. Her toothless mouth worked craftily at the cigarette held there, blowing out puffs of blue smoke that seemed to hang above and behind her in little bunched blue balls. She puffed back and forth, describing a triangle between counter, skillet, and table. Her cotton stockings were rolled at the knee, and above them and the flapping hem of her dress, varicose veins bunched in clock springs. The apartment was haunted by the ghost of long-departed cabbage. In the far bedroom, Cassie screamed, whooped, and was silent. Bradley had told Richards with a kind of angry shame that he should not mind her. She had cancer in both lungs, and recently it had spread upward into her throat and down into her belly. She was 5. Stacy had gone back out somewhere. As he and Bradley spoke together, the maddening aroma of simmering ground beef, vegetables, and tomato sauce began to fill the room, driving the cabbage back into the corners and making Richards realize how hungry he was.
"I could turn you in, man. I could kill you and steal all that money. Turn in the body, get $1,000 more and be on Easy Street."
"I don't think you could do it," Richards said. "I know I couldn't."
"Why are you doing it anyway?"
Bradley asked irritably.
"Why are you being their sucker? You that greedy?"
"My little girl's name is Kathy," Richard said, "younger than Cassie. Pneumonia. She cries all the time, too." Bradley said nothing. "She could get better. Not like her in there. Pneumonia's no worse than a cold, but you have to have medicine and a doctor. That costs money. I went for the money the only way I could."
"You still a sucker,"
Bradley said with flat and somehow uncanny emphasis. "You sucking off half the world and they coming in your mouth every night at 6:30.
Your little girl would be better off like Cassie in this world.
I don't believe that.
Then you ballsier than me, man. I put a guy in the hospital once with a rupture, some rich guy. Cops chased me 3 days, but you ballsier than me.
He took a cigarette and lit it.
Maybe you'll go the whole month. $1 billion. You'd have to buy a fucking freight train to haul it off.
Don't swear, praise God, the old woman said from across the room where she was slicing carrots.
Bradley paid no attention.
You and your wife and little girl would be on Easy Street then. You got 2 days already.
No, Richard said. The game's rigged. You know those two things I gave Stacy to mail when he and your ma went out for groceries? I have to mail two of those every day before midnight.
He explained to Bradley about the forfeit clause and his suspicion that they had traced him to Boston by postmark.
Easy to beat that.
How?
Never mind. Later. How you gonna get out of Boston? You awful hot. Made a mad blowing up their oinkers at the YMCA.
They had Freevy on that tonight.
And those ones you took with the bag over your head, that was pretty sharp.
Ma,
he finished irritably, when's that stuff gonna be ready? We're falling away to shadows right before you.
She coming on, Ma said.
She plopped a cover over the rich, slowly bubbling mass and walked slowly into the bedroom to sit by the girl.
I don't know, Richard said.
I'll try to get a car, I guess. I've got fake papers, but I don't dare use them.
I'll do something, wear dark glasses, and get out of the city. I've been thinking about going to Vermont and then crossing over into Canada.
Bradley grunted and got up to put plates on the table.
By now they got every highway going out of Beantown blocked. A man wearing dark glasses calls attention to himself. They'll turn you into monkey meat before you get 6 miles.
Then I don't know, Richard said. If I stay here, they'll get you for an accessory.
Bradley began spreading dishes.
Suppose we get a car. You got the squeezing green. I got a name that isn't hot. There's a spick on Milk Street that'll sell me a Wint for $300. I'll get one of my buddies to drive it up to Manchester. It'll be cool as a fool in Manchester because you're bottled up in Boston.
You eating, Ma?
Yes, and praise God. She waddled out of the bedroom. Your sister is sleeping a little.
Good.
He ladled up 3 dishes of hamburger gumbo and then paused.
Where's Stacy?
Said he was going to the drug,
Ma said complacently, shoveling gumbo into her toothless maw at a blinding speed.
Said he going to get medicine.
If he gets busted, I'll break his ass,
Bradley said, sitting heavily.
He won't, Richard said. He's got money.
Yeah, maybe we don't need no charity money, gray meat.
Richards laughed and salted his meal.
I'd probably be slabbed now if it wasn't for him, he said. I guess it was earned money.
Bradley leaned forward, concentrating on his plate. None of them said anything more until the meal was done. Richards and Bradley had 2 helpings. The old woman had 3. As they were lighting cigarettes, a key scratched in the lock, and all of them stiffened until Stacy came in, looking guilty, frightened, and excited. He was carrying a brown bag in one hand, and he gave Ma a bottle of medicine.
That's prime dope, he said.
That old man Curry asked me where I got $2.75 to buy prime dope, and I told him to go shit in his boot and eat it.
Don't swear, or the devil will poke you,
Ma said. Here's dinner. The boy's eyes widened.
Jesus, there's meat in it.
Nah, we just shat in it to make it thicker,
Bradley said. The boy looked up sharply, saw his brother was joking, giggled, and fell to.
Will that druggist go to the cops?
Richards asked quietly.
Curry?
Nah.
Not if there might be some more squeezing green in this family. He knows Cassie's got to have heavy dope.
What about this Manchester thing?
Yeah. Well, Vermont's no good. Not enough of our kind of people. Tough cops. I get some good fellow like Rich Goleon to drive that Wint to Manchester and park it in an automatic garage. Then I drive you up in another car.
He crushed out his cigarette.
In the trunk. They're only using jiffy sniffers on the back road. We'll go right at 495.
Pretty dangerous for you, Richard said.
Oh, I wasn't going to do it free. When Cassie goes, she's going to go out wrecked.
Praise God, Ma said.
Still pretty dangerous for you.
Any pig grunts at Bradley, he make him shit in their boot and eat it,
Stacy said, wiping his mouth. When he looked at Bradley, his eyes glittered with the flat shine of hero worship.
You're dribbling on your shirt, Skinner,
Bradley said. He knuckled Stacy's head.
You beating your meat yet, Skinner? Ain't big enough, are you?
If they catch us, you'll go in for the long bomb, Richard said. Who's going to take care of the boy?
He'll take care of himself if something happens, Bradley said. Himself and Ma here, he's not hooked on nothing, are you, Stace?
Stacy shook his head emphatically.
And he knows if I find any pricks in his arms, I'll beat his brains out. Ain't that right, Stacy?
Stacy nodded.
Besides, we can use the money. This is a hurting family. So don't say no more about it. I guess I know what I'm doing.
Richards finished his cigarette in silence while Bradley went in to give Cassie some medicine. -063 and counting. When he awoke, it was still dark, and the inner tide of his body put the time at about 4:30. The girl, Cassie, had been screaming, and Bradley got up. The three of them were sleeping in the small, drafty back bedroom, Stacy and Richards on the floor. Ma slept with the girl. Over the steady wheeze of Stacy's deep sleep respiration, Richards heard Bradley come out of the room. There was a clink of a spoon in the sink. The girl's screams became isolated moans, which trailed into silence. Richards could sense Bradley standing somewhere in the kitchen, immobile, waiting for the silence to come. He returned, sat down, farted, and then the bedspring shifted creakily as he lay down. Bradley?
What?
Stacy said she was only 5, is that so?
Yes.
The urban dialectic was gone from his voice, making him sound unreal and dreamlike. What's a 5-year-old kid doing with lung cancer? I didn't know they got it. Leukemia, maybe. Not lung cancer. There was a bitter, whispered chuckle from the bed.
You're from Harding, right? What's the air pollution count in Harding?
I don't know, Richard said.
They don't give them with the weather anymore. They haven't for,
a long time.
Not since 2020 in Boston, Bradley whispered back. They're scared to. You ain't got a nose filter, do you?
Don't be stupid, Richard said irritably. The goddamn things cost $200 even in the cut-rate stores. I didn't see $200 all last year, did you?
No,
Bradley said softly. He paused.
Stacy's got one. I made it. Ma and Rich Golion and some other people got them, too.
You're shitting me, Richard said.
No, man.
He stopped. Richards was suddenly sure that Bradley was weighing what he had said already against a great many more things which he might say, wondering how much was too much. When the words came again, they came with difficulty.
We've been reading. That freebie shit is for empty heads.
Richards grunted agreement.
The gang, you know? Some of the guys are just cruisers, you know? All they're interested in is honky-stomping on Saturday night. But some of us have been going down to the library since we were 12 or so.
They let you in without a card in Boston?
No, you can't get a card unless there's someone with a guaranteed income of $5,000 a year in your family. We got some plump-ass kid and kifed his card. We take turns going. We got a gang suit we wear when we go.
Bradley paused. You laugh at me and I'll cut you, man. I'm not laughing.
At first, we only read sex books. Then when Cassie first started getting sick, I got into this pollution stuff. They've got all the books on impurity counts and smog levels and nose filters in the reserve section. We got a key made from a wax blank. Man, did you know that everybody in Tokyo had to wear a nose filter by 2012?
No.
Rich and Dink Moran built a pollution counter. Dink drew the picture out of the book, and they did it from coffee cans and some stuff they boosted out of cars. It's hid out in an alley. Back in 1978, they had an air pollution scale that went from 1 to 20, you understand?
Yes.
When it got up to 12, the factories and all the pollution-producing shit had to shut down until the weather changed. It was a federal law until 1987, when the revised Congress rolled it back.
The shadow on the bed rose up on its elbow.
I bet you know a lot of people with asthma, then, right?
Sure, Richard said cautiously. I've got a touch myself.
You get that from the air? Christ, everybody knows you stay in the house when it's hot and cloudy and the air doesn't move. Temperature inversion, Bradley said grimly.
And lots of people get asthma, sure. The air gets like cough syrup in August and September, but lung cancer.
You ain't talking about asthma, Bradley said. You're talking about emphysema.
Emphysema? Richards turned the word over in his mind. He could not assign a meaning to it, although the word was faintly familiar.
All the tissues in your lungs swell up. You heave and heave and heave, but you're still out of breath. You know a lot of people who get like that?
Richard thought. He did. He knew a lot of people who had died like that.
They don't talk about that one,
Bradley said, as if he had read Richard's thought.
Now the pollution count in Boston is 20 on a good day. That's like smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day, just breathing. On a bad day, it gets up as high as 42. Old dudes drop dead all over town. Asthma goes on the death certificate, but it's the air, the air, the air. And they're pouring it out just as fast as they can. Big smokestacks going 24 hours a day. The big boys like it that way. Those $200 nose filters aren't worth shit. They're just two pieces of screen with a little piece of methylated cotton between them. That's all. The only good ones are from General Atomics. The only ones who can afford them are the big boys. They gave us the freebie to keep us off the streets so we can breathe ourselves to death without making any trouble. How do you like that? The cheapest GA nose filter on the market goes for $6,000. We made one for Stacy for $10 from that book. We used an atomic nugget the size of the moon on your fingernail. Got it out of a hearing aid we bought in a hawk shop for $7. How do you like that?
Richard said nothing. He was speechless.
When Cassie boots off, you think they'll put cancer on the death certificate? Shit, they'll put asthma. Else somebody might get scared.
Somebody might kife a library card and find out lung cancer is up 700% since 2015. Is that true, or are you making it up?
I read it in a book. Man, they're killing us. The freebie is killing us. It's like a magician getting you to watch the cakes falling out of his helper's blouse while he pulls rabbits out of his pants and puts them in his hat.
He paused and then said dreamily, "Sometimes I think that I could blow the whole thing out of the water with 10 minutes talk time on the freebie.
Tell them. Show them. Everybody could have a nose filter if the network wanted them to have them."
"And I'm helping them," Richard said.
"That ain't your fault. You've got to run."
Killian's face and the face of Arthur M. Burns rose up in front of Richard's. He wanted to smash them, stomp them, walk on them. Better still, rip out their nose filters and turn them into the street.
"People's mad," Bradley said. "They've been mad at the honkies for 30 years. All they need is a reason. A reason. One reason."
Richards drifted off to sleep with the repetition in his ears. -062 and counting. Richards stayed in all day while Bradley was out seeing about the car and arranging with another member of the gang to drive it to Manchester. Bradley and Stacy came back at 6, and Bradley thumbed on the freebie.
"All set, man. We go tonight."
"Now?" Bradley smiled humorlessly.
"Don't you want to see yourself coast to coast?"
Richards discovered he did. And when the running man lead-in came on, he watched, fascinated. Bobby Thompson stared deadpan at the camera from the middle of a brilliant post in a sea of darkness.
"Watch," he said. "This is one of the wolves that walks among you."
A huge blow-up of Richards' face appeared on the screen. It held for a moment, then dissolved to a second photo of Richards, this time in the John Griffin Springer disguise. Dissolved back to Thompson, looking grave. "I speak particularly to the people of Boston tonight. Yesterday afternoon, 5 policemen went to a blazing, agonized death in the basement of the Boston YMCA at the hands of this wolf, who had set a clever, merciless trap. Who is he tonight? Where is he tonight? Look! Look at him!" Thompson faded into the first of the 2 clips which Richards had filmed that morning. Stacy had dropped them in a mailbox on Commonwealth Avenue across the city. He had let Ma hold the camera in the back bedroom after he had draped the window and all the furniture. "All of you watching this," Richards' image said slowly. "Not the technicos, not the people in the penthouses. I don't mean you shits. You people in the developments, in the ghettos, and the cheap high-rises. You people in the cycle gangs. You people without jobs. You kids getting busted for dope you don't have and crimes you didn't commit because the network wants to make sure you aren't meeting together and talking together. I want to tell you about a monstrous conspiracy to deprive you of the very breath in your..." The audio suddenly became a mixture of squeaks, pops, and gargles. A moment later, it died altogether. Richards' mouth was moving, but no sound was coming out.
"We seem to have lost our audio,"
Bobby Thompson's voice came smoothly. But we don't need to listen to any more of this murderer's radical ravings to understand what we're dealing with, do we?
No,
the audience screamed. What will you do if you see him on your street?
Turn him in.
And what are we going to do when we find him?
Kill him.
Richards pounded his fist against the tired arm of the only easy chair in the apartment's kitchen living room. Those bastards, he said helplessly.
Did you think they'd let you go on the air with it? Bradley asked mockingly. Oh, no, man. I'm surprised they let you get away with as much as they did.
I didn't think, Richard said sickly.
No, I guess you didn't, Bradley said.
The first clip faded into the second. In this one, Richards had asked the people watching to storm the libraries, demand cards, find out the truth. He had read off a list of books dealing with air pollution and water pollution that Bradley had given him. Richards' image opened its mouth. Fuck every one of you, his image said. The lips seemed to be moving around different words, but how many of the 200 million people watching were going to notice that? Fuck all pigs. Fuck the Games Commission. I'm going to kill every pig I see. I'm going to... There was more, enough so that Richards wanted to plug his ears and run out of the room. He couldn't tell if it was the voice of a mimic or a harangue made up of spliced bits of audio tape. The clip faded to a split screen of Thompson's face and the still photo of Richards. Behold the man, Thompson said. The man who would kill. The man who would mobilize an army of malcontents like himself to run riot through your streets, raping and burning and overturning. The man would lie, cheat, kill. He has done all these things. Benjamin Richards, the voice cried out with a cold, commanding Old Testament anger. Are you watching? If so, you have been paid your dirty blood money, $100 for each hour, now number 54, that you have remained free, and an extra $500, 100 for each of these 5 men. The faces of young, clear-featured policemen began appearing on the screen. The still had apparently been taken at a police academy graduation exercise. They looked fresh, full of sap and hope, heartbreakingly vulnerable. Softly, a single trumpet began to play taps. And these? Thompson's voice was now low and hoarse with emotion. These were their families. Wives hopefully smiling. Children that had been coaxed to smile into the camera. A lot of children. Richards, cold and sick and nauseated, lowered his head and pressed the back of his hand over his mouth. Bradley's hand, warm and muscular, pressed his neck.
Hey, no. No, man. That's put on. That's all fake. They were probably a bunch of old harness bulls who...
Shut up, Richards said. Oh, shut up. Just, please, shut up. $500, Thompson was saying. An infinite hate and contempt filled his voice. Richards' face on the screen again, cold, hard, devoid of all emotion save an expression of bloodlust that seemed chiefly to be in the eyes. 5 police, 5 wives, 19 children. It comes to just about $17.25 for each of the dead, the bereaved, the heartbroken. Oh yes, you work cheap, Ben Richards. Even Judas got 30 pieces of silver, but you don't even demand that. Somewhere, even now, a mother is telling her little boy that Daddy won't be home ever again because a desperate, greedy man with a gun...
Killer,
a woman was sobbing.
Vile, dirty murderer, God will strike you dead.
Strike him dead, the audience over the chant. Behold the man. He has been paid his blood money, but the man who lives by violence shall die by it. And let every man's hand be raised against Benjamin Richards. Hate and fear in every voice, rising in a steady throbbing roar. No, they wouldn't turn him in. They would rip him to shreds on sight. Bradley turned off the screen and faced him.
That's what you're dealing with, man. How about it?
Maybe I'll kill them, Richard said in a thoughtful voice. Maybe before I'm done, I'll get up to the 19th floor of that place and just hunt up the maggots who wrote that. Maybe I'll just kill them all.
Don't talk no more,
Stacy burst out wildly.
Don't talk no more about it.
In the other room, Kathy slept her drugged, dying sleep. -061 and counting. Bradley had not dared drill any holes in the floor of the trunk, so Richards curled in a miserable ball with his mouth and nose pressed toward the tiny notch of light which was the trunk's keyhole. Bradley had also pulled out some of the inner trunk insulation around the lid, and that let in a small draft. The car lifted with a jerk, and he knocked his head against the upper deck. Bradley had told him the ride would be at least an hour and a half, with two stops for roadblocks, perhaps more. Before he closed the trunk, he gave Richards a large revolver. "Every 10th or 12th car, they give it a heavy looking over," he said. They opened the trunk to poke around. "Those are good odds, 11-1. If he don't come up, plug you some pork." The car lurched and heaved over the potholed, cracked, crazed streets of the inner city. Once a kid jeered and there was the thump of a thrown piece of paving. Then the sounds of increasing traffic all around them and more frequent stops for lights. Richards lay passively, holding the pistol lightly in his right hand, thinking how different Bradley had looked in the gang suit. It was a sober Dillon Street double-breasted, as gray as bank walls. It was rounded off with a maroon tie and a small gold NAACP pin. Bradley had made the leap from scruffy gang member, pregnant ladies stay away, some of us and eat fetuses, to a sober black business fellow who would know exactly who to tom. "You look good," Richard said admiringly. "In fact, it's damn incredible."
"Praise God," Ma said.
"I thought you'd enjoy the transformation, my good man," Bradley said with quiet dignity. "I'm the district manager for Raygun Chemicals, you know. We do a thriving business in this area. Fine city, Boston. Immensely convivial." Stacy burst into giggles. "You best shut up, nigger," Bradley said, "else I make you shit in your boot and eat it."
"You tom so good, Bradley," Stacy giggled, not intimidated in the least. "You really fucking funky."
Now the car swung right onto a smoother surface and descended in a spiraling arc. They were on an entrance ramp, going on to 495, or a feeder expressway. Copper wires of tension were stuffed into his legs.
1 in 11, that's not bad odds.
The car picked up speed and height, kicked into drive, then slowed abruptly and kicked out. A voice, terrifyingly close, yelling with monotonous regularity, "Pull over, have your license and registration ready. Pull over, have your..."
"Already, starting already. You so hot, man."
"Hot enough to check the trunk on one car in 8? Or 6? Or maybe every one?" The car came to a full stop. Richards' eyes moved like trapped rabbits in their sockets. He gripped the revolver. -060, and counting. "Step out your vehicle, sir," the bored, authoritative voice was saying. "License and registration, please." A door opened and closed. The engine thrummed softly, holding the car an inch off the pavement. "District manager for Raygun Chemicals." Bradley going into his song and dance. Dear God, what if he didn't have the papers to back it up? What if there was no Raygun Chemicals? The back door opened, and someone began rummaging in the back seat. It sounded as if the cop, or was it the government guard that did this, Richard wondered half-coherently, was about to crawl right into the trunk with him. The door slammed. Feet walked around to the back of the car. Richards licked his lips and held the gun tighter. Visions of dead policemen gibbered before him. Angelic faces on twisted porcine bodies. He wondered if the cop would hose him with machine gun bullets when he opened the trunk and saw Richards lying here like a curled-up salamander. He wondered if Bradley would take off, try to run. He was going to piss himself. He hadn't done that since he was a kid, and his brother would tickle him until his bladder let go. Yes, all those muscles down there were loosening. He would put the bullet right at the juncture of the cop's nose and forehead, splattering brains and splintered skull fragments in startled streamers to the sky. Make a few more orphans. Yes, good. Jesus loves me, this I know, for my bladder tells me so. Christ Jesus, what's he doing, ripping the seat out? Sheila, I love you so much, and how far will 6 grand take you? A year, maybe, if they don't kill you for it. Then on the street again, up and down, cross on the corner, swinging the hips, flirting with the empty pocketbook. Hey, mister, I go down. This is clean kitty, kid. Teach you how. A hand whacked the top of the trunk casually in passing. Richards bit back a scream. Dust in his nostrils, throat tickling. High school biology sitting in the back row, scratching his initials and Sheila's on the ancient desktop. The sneeze is a function of the involuntary muscles. I'm going to sneeze my goddamn head off, but it's point blank, and I can still put that bullet right through his squash. And what's in the trunk, mister? Bradley's voice, jocular, a little bored. A spare cylinder that doesn't work half right. I got the key on my ring. Wait, I'll get it. If I wanted it, I'd ask. Other back door opened, closed. Drive on. Hang tight, fella. Hope you get him. Drive on, mister. Move your ass. The cylinders cranked up. The car lifted and accelerated. It slowed once and must have been waved on. Richards jolted a little as the car rose, sailed a little, and kicked into drive. His breath came in tired little moans. He didn't have to sneeze anymore. -059 and counting. The ride seemed much longer than an hour and a half, and they were stopped twice more. One of them seemed to be a routine license check. At the next one, a drawling cop with a dull-witted voice talked to Bradley for some time about how the goddamn commie bikers were helping that guy Richards, and probably the other one, too. Laughlin had not killed anyone, but it was rumored that he had raped a woman in Topeka. After that, there was nothing but the monotonous whine of the wind and the scream of his own cramped and frozen muscles. Richards did not sleep, but his punished mind did finally push him into a dazed semi-consciousness. There was no carbon monoxide with the air cars, thank God for that. Centuries after the last roadblock, the car kicked into a lower gear and banked up a spiraling exit ramp. Richards blinked sluggishly and wondered if he was going to throw up. For the first time in his life, he felt car sick. They went through a sickening series of loops and dives that Richards supposed was a traffic interchange. Another 5 minutes, and city sounds took over again. Richards tried repeatedly to shift his body into a new position, but it was impossible. He finally subsided, waiting numbly for it to be over. His right arm, which was curled under him, had gone to sleep an hour ago. Now it felt like a block of wood. He could touch it with the tip of his nose and feel only the pressure on his nose. They took a right, went straight for a little, then turned again. The bottom dropped out of Richards' stomach as the car dipped down a sharp incline. The echoing of the cylinders told him that they were inside. They had gotten to the garage. A little helpless sound of relief escaped him. "Got your check, buddy?" a voice asked. "Right here, pal. Rampway 5. Thanks." They bore right. The car went up, paused, turned right again, then left. They settled into idle, then the car dropped with a soft bump as the engine died. Journey's end. There was a pause. Then the hollow sound of Bradley's door opening and closing. His footsteps clicked toward the trunk. Then the chink of light in front of Richard's eyes disappeared as the key slid home. "You there, Benny?" "No," he croaked. "You left me back at the state line. Open this goddamn thing." "Just a second. Place is empty right now. Your car is parked next to us, on the right. Can you get out quick?" "I don't know." "Try hard. Here we go." The trunk lid popped up, letting in dim garage light. Richards got up on one arm, got one leg over the edge, and could go no farther. His cramped body screamed. Bradley took one arm and hauled him out. His legs wanted a buckle. Bradley hooked him under the armpit and half led, half pushed him to the battered green wint on the right. He propped open the driver's side door, shoved Richards in, and slammed it shut. A moment later, Bradley also slid in. "Jesus," he said softly. "We got here, man. We got here." "Yeah," Richard said. "Back to go. Collect $200. They smoked in the shadows, their cigarettes gleaming like eyes. For a little while, neither of them said anything. -058 and counting. "We almost got it at that first roadblock," Bradley was saying as Richards tried to massage feeling back into his arm. It felt as if phantom nails had been pushed into it. "That cop almost opened it. Almost." He blew out smoke in a huge huff. Richards said nothing. "How do you feel?" Bradley asked presently. "It's getting better. Take my wallet out for me. I can't make my arm work just right yet." Bradley shooed the words away with one hand. "Later. I want to tell you how Rich and I set it up." Richards lit another cigarette from the stub of the first. A dozen Charlie horses were loosening slowly. "There's a hotel room reserved for you on Winthrop Street. The Winthrop House is the name of the place. Sounds fancy. It ain't. The name is Ogden Grassner. Can you remember that?" "Yes. I'll be recognized immediately." Bradley reached into the back seat, got a box, and dropped it in Richards' lap. It was long, brown, tied with string. To Richards, it looked like the kind of box that rented graduation gowns come in. He looked at Bradley questioningly. "Open it." He did. There was a pair of thick blue-tinted glasses lying on top of a drift of black cloth. Richards put the glasses on the dashboard and took out the garment. It was a priest's robe. Beneath it, lying on the bottom of the box, was a rosary, a Bible, and a purple stole.
A priest? Richards asked.
Right. You change right here. I'll help you. There's a cane in the back seat. Your act ain't blind, but it's pretty close. Bump into things.
You're in Manchester to attend a council of churches meeting on drug abuse, got it?
Yes, Richards said.
He hesitated, fingers on the buttons of his shirt. Do I wear my pants under this rig?
Bradley burst out laughing. Minus 057 and counting.
Bradley talked rapidly as he drove Richards across town.
There's a box of gummed mailing labels in your suitcase, he said.
That's in the trunk. The stickers say, after 5 days, return to Brickhill Manufacturing Company, Manchester, New Hampshire. Rich and another guy ran them off. They got a press at the Stabbers headquarters on Boylston Street. Every day you send your two tapes to me in a box with one of those stickers. I'll mail them to Games from Boston. Send the stuff speed delivery. That's when they'll never figure out.
The car cozied up to the curb in front of the Winthrop house.
This car will be back in the U Park. Don't try to drive out of Manchester unless you change your disguise. You gotta be a chameleon, man.
How long do you think it'll be safe here? Richards asked.
He thought, I'd put myself in his hands. It didn't seem that he could think rationally for himself anymore.
He could smell mental exhaustion on himself like body odor.
Your reservation's for a week.
That might be okay, it might not. Play it by ear.
There's a name and an address in the suitcase. Fella in Portland, Maine. They'll hide you for a day or two. It'll cost, but they're safe. I gotta go, man. This is a 5-minute zone. Money time.
How much? Richards asked.
600.
Bullshit. That doesn't even cover expenses.
Yes, it does, with a few bucks left over for the family.
Take 1,000.
You need your dough, pal.
Richards looked at him helplessly.
Christ, Bradley. Send us more if you make it. Send us a million. Put us on Easy Street.
Do you think I will?
Bradley smiled a soft, sad smile and said nothing.
Then why? Richards asked flatly. Why are you doing so much?
I can understand you hiding me out. I'd do that.
But you must have busted your club's arm.
They didn't mind. They know the score.
What score? Ought to not. That score. If we don't stick out our necks for our own, they got us. No need to wait for the air. We could just as well run a pipe from the stove to the living room, turn on the freebie and wait.
Someone will kill you, Richard said. Someone will stool on you and you'll end up on a basement floor with your guts beat out, or Stacy, or Ma.
Bradley's eyes flashed dimly.
A bad day is coming, though. A bad day for the maggots with their guts full of roast beef. I see blood on the moon for them. Guns and torches. A mojo that walks and talks.
People have been seeing those things for 2,000 years.
The 5-minute buzzer went off and Richards fumbled for the door handle.
Thank you, he said.
I don't know how to say it any other way.
Go on, Bradley said, before I get a ticket.
A strong brown hand clutched the robe.
And when they get you, take a few along.
Richards opened the rear door and popped the trunk to get the black satchel inside.
Bradley handed him a cordovan-colored cane wordlessly.
The car pulled out into traffic smoothly. Richard stood on the curb for a moment, watching him go, watching him myopically, he hoped. The taillights flashed once at the corner, then the car swung out of sight, back to the parking lot where Bradley would leave it and pick up the other to go back to Boston. Richards had a weird sensation of relief and realized that he was feeling empathy for Bradley. How glad he must be to have me off his back, finally.
Richards made himself miss the first step up to the Winthrop house's entrance, and the doorman assisted him.
Minus 056 and counting. 2 days passed. Richards played his part well, that is to say, as if his life depended on it. He took dinner at the hotel both nights in his room. He rose at 7, read his Bible in the lobby, and then went out to his meeting. The hotel staff treated him with easy, contemptuous cordiality, the kind reserved for half-blind, fumbling clerics who paid their bills. In this day of limited legalized murder, germ warfare in Egypt and South America, and the notorious have-one-kill-one Nevada abortion law. The Pope was a muttering old man of 96 whose driveling edicts concerning such current events were reported as the closing humorous items on the 7 o'clock newsies. Richards held his one-man meetings in a rented library cubicle
where, with the door locked, he was reading about pollution. There is very little information later than 2002, and what there was seemed to gel very badly with what had been written before. The government, as usual, was doing a tardy but efficient job of double-thinking. At noon, he made his way down to a luncheonette on the corner of a street not far from the hotel, bumping into people and excusing himself as he went. Some people told him it was quite all right, Father. Most simply cursed in an uninterested way and pushed him aside. He spent the afternoons in his room and ate dinner watching The Running Man. He had mailed 4 film clips while en route to the library during the mornings. The forwarding from Boston seemed to be going smoothly. The producers of the program had adopted a new tactic for killing Richards' pollution message. He persisted with it in a kind of grinning frenzy. He had to be getting through to the lip readers anyway. Now the crowd drowned out the voice with a rising storm of jeers, screams, obscenities, and vituperation. Their sound grew increasingly more frenzied, ugly to the point of dementia. In his long afternoons, Richards reflected that an unwilling change had come over him during his 5 days on the run. Bradley had done it. Bradley and the little girl. There was no longer just himself, a lone man fighting for his family, bound to be cut down. Now there were all of them out there, strangling on their own respiration, his family included. He had never been a social man. He had shunned causes with contempt and disgust. They were for pig-simple suckers and people with too much time and money on their hands, like those half-assed college kids with their cute buttons and their neo-rock groups. Richards' father had slunk into the night when Richards was 5. Richards had been too young to remember him in anything but flashes. He had never hated him for it. He understood well enough how a man with a choice between pride and responsibility will almost always choose pride if responsibility robs him of his manhood. A man can't stick around and watch his wife earning supper on her back. If a man can't do any more than pimp for the woman he married, Richards judged, he might as well walk out of a high window. He had spent the years between 5 and 16 hustling. He and his brother Todd. His mother had died of syphilis when he was 10, and Todd was 7. Todd had been killed 5 years later when a newsy air truck had lost its emergency brake on a hill while Todd was loading it. The city had fed both mother and son into the municipal crematorium. The kids on the street called it either the ash factory or the creamery. They were bitter but helpless, knowing that they themselves would most likely end up being belched out of the stacks and into the city's air. At 16... Richards was alone, working a full 8-hour shift as an engine wiper after school. And in spite of his back-breaking schedule, he had felt a constant panic that came from knowing he was alone and unknown, drifting free. He awoke sometimes at 3 in the morning to the rotted cabbage smell of the one-room tenement flat, with terror lodged in the deepest chamber of his soul. He was his own man. And so he had married. And Sheila had spent the first year in proud silence. While their friends, and Richards' enemies, he had made many by his refusal to go along on mass vandalizing expeditions and join a local gang, waited for the uterus express to arrive. When it didn't, interest flagged. They were left in that particular limbo that was reserved for newlyweds in Co-op City. Few friends and a circle of acquaintances that reached only as far as the stoop of their own building. Richards did not mind this. It suited him. He threw himself into his work wholly, with grinning intensity, getting overtime when he could. The wages were bad, there was no chance of advancement, and inflation was running wild, but they were in love. They remained in love, and why not? Richards was that kind of solitary man who can afford to expend gigantic charges of love, affection, and perhaps psychic domination on the woman of his choice. Up until that point, his emotions had been almost entirely untouched. In the 11 years of their marriage, they had never argued significantly. He quit his job in 2018, because the chances of ever having children decreased with every shift he spent behind the leaky GA old-style lead shields. He might have been all right if he answered the foreman's aggrieved, "Why are you quitting?" with a lie. But Richards had told him simply and clearly what he thought of General Atomics, concluding with an invitation to the foreman to take all his gamma shields and perform a reverse bowel movement with them. It ended in a short, savage scuffle. The foreman was brawny and looked tough, but Richards made him scream like a woman. The black ball began to roll. "He's dangerous. Steer clear. If you need a man bad, put him on for a week and then get rid of him." In GA parlance, Richards had shown red. During the next 5 years, he had spent a lot of time rolling and loading newsies. but the work thinned to a trickle and then died. The freebie killed the printed word very effectively. Richards pounded the pavement. Richards was moved along. Richards worked intermittently for day labor outfits. The great movements of the decade passed by him ignored, like ghosts to an unbeliever. He knew nothing of the housewife massacre in 24 until his wife told him about it 3 weeks later. 200 police armed with Tommy guns and high-powered move-alongs had turned back an army of women marching on the Southwest Food Depository. 60 had been killed. He was vaguely aware that nerve gas was being used in the Mideast, but none of it affected him. Protest did not work. Violence did not work. The world was what it was, and Ben Richards moved through it like a thin scythe, asking for nothing, looking for work. He ferreted out 100 miserable day and half-day jobs. He worked cleaning jelly-like slime from under piers and in sump ditches, when others on the street who honestly believed they were looking for work did nothing. Move along, maggot. Get lost. No job. Get out. Put on your boogie shoes. I'll blow your effing head off, Daddy. Move. Then the jobs dried up. Impossible to find anything. A rich man in a silk singlet, drunk, accosted him on the street one evening as Richards shambled home after a fruitless day, and told him he would give Richards $10 new if Richards would pull down his pants so he could see if the street freaks really did have peckers a foot long. Richards knocked him down and ran. It was then, after 9 years of trying, that Sheila conceived. He was a wiper, the people in the building said. Can you believe he was a wiper for 6 years and knocked her up? It'll be a monster, the people in the building said. It'll have two heads and no eyes. Radiation, radiation, your children will be monsters. But instead, it was Kathy, round, perfect, squalling, delivered by a midwife from down the block who took 50 cents and 4 cans of beans. And now, for the first time since his brother had died, he was drifting again. Every pressure, even temporarily the pressure of the chase, had been removed. His mind and his anger turned toward the Games Federation, with their huge and potent communications linked to the whole world. Fat people with nose filters, spending their evenings with dollies and silk underpants. Let the guillotine fall, and fall, and fall. Yet there was no way to get them. They towered above all of them, dimly, like the Games building itself. Yet, because he was who he was, and because he was alone and changing, he thought about it. He was unaware, alone in his room, that while he thought about it, he grinned a huge white wolf grin that in itself seemed powerful enough to buckle streets and melt buildings. The same grin he had worn on that almost forgotten day when he had knocked a rich man down and then fled with his pockets empty and his mind burning. -055 and counting. Monday was exactly the same as Sunday. The working world took no one particular day off anymore. Until 6:30. Father Ogden Grassner had meatloaf supreme sent up. The hotel's cuisine, which would have seemed execrable to a man who had been weaned on anything better than fast food hamburgers and concentrate pills, tasted great to Richards. With a bottle of Thunderbird wine, and settled down to watch the running man. The first segment, dealing with Richards himself, went much as it had on the two nights previous. The audio on his clips was drowned out by the studio audience. Bobby Thompson was urbane and virulent. A house-to-house search was taking place in Boston. Anyone found harboring the fugitive would be put to death. Richards smiled without humor as they faded to a network promo. It wasn't so bad, it was even funny in a limited way. He could stand anything if they didn't broadcast the cops again. The second half of the program was markedly different. Thompson was smiling broadly. After the latest tape sent to us by the monster that goes under the name of Ben Richards, I am pleased to give you some good news. They had gotten Laughlin. He had been spotted in Topeka on Friday, but an intensive search of the city on Saturday and Sunday had not turned him up. Richards had assumed that Laughlin had slipped through the cordon, as he had himself. But this afternoon, Laughlin had been observed by 2 kids. He had been cowering in a highway department road shed. He had broken his right wrist at some point. The kids, Bobby and Mary Cowles, were shown grinning broadly into the camera. Bobby Cowles had a tooth missing. I wonder if the tooth fairy brought him a quarter, Richards thought sickly. Thompson announced proudly that Bobby and Mary, Topeka's number one citizens, would be on the running man tomorrow night to be presented certificates of merit, a lifetime supply of Fun Twink cereal, and checks for $1,000 new dollars each by His Honor the Governor of Kansas.
This brought wild cheers from the audience. Following were tapes of Laughlin's riddled, sagging body being carried out of the shed, which had been reduced to matchwood by concentrated fire. There were mingled cheers, boos, and hisses from the studio audience. Richards turned away, sickly, nauseated. Thin, invisible fingers seemed to press against his temples. From a distance, the words rolled on. The body was being displayed in the rotunda of the Kansas State House. Already, long lines of citizens were filing past the body. An interviewed policeman who had been in at the kill said Laughlin hadn't put up much of a fight. Oh, how nice for you, Richards thought, remembering Laughlin, his sour voice, the straight-ahead jeering look in his eyes. A friend of mine from the carpool. Now there was only one big show. The big show was Ben Richards. He didn't want any more of his meatloaf supreme. -054 and counting. He had a very bad dream that night, which was unusual. The old Ben Richards had never dreamed. What was even more peculiar was the fact that he did not exist as a character in the dream. He only watched, invisible. The room was vague, dimming off to blackness at the edges of vision. It seemed that water was dripping dankly. Richards had an impression of being deep underground. In the center of the room, Bradley was sitting in a straight wooden chair with leather straps over his arms and legs. His head had been shaved like that of a penitent. Surrounding him were figures in black hoods. The hunters, Richards thought with budding dread. Oh, dear God, these are the hunters. I ain't the man, Bradley said. Yes, you are, little brother, one of the hooded figures said gently, and pushed a pin through Bradley's cheek. Bradley screamed. Are you the man? Suck it. A pin slid easily into Bradley's eyeball and was withdrawn, dribbling colorless fluid. Bradley's eye took on a punched, flattened look. Are you the man? Poke it up your ass. An electric move-along touched Bradley's neck. He screamed again, and his hair stood on end. He looked like a comical caricature black, a futuristic step-in-fetch-it. Are you the man, little brother? Nose filters give you cancer, Bradley said. You're all rotted inside, honkies. His other eyeball was pierced. Are you the man? Bradley, blind, laughed at them. One of the hooded figures gestured, and from the shadows, Bobby and Mary Cowles came tripping gaily. They began to skip around Bradley, singing, Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf, the Big Bad Wolf, the Big Bad Wolf? Bradley began to scream and twist in the chair. He seemed to be trying to hold his hands up in a warding off gesture. The song grew louder and louder, more echoing. The children were changing. Their heads were elongating, growing dark with blood. Their mouths were open, and in the caves within, fangs twinkled like razor blades. I'll tell, Bradley screamed. I'll tell, I ain't the man. Ben Richards is the man. I'll tell, God, oh, good God. Where is the man, little brother? I'll tell, he's in... But the words were drowned by the singing voices. They were lunging toward Bradley's straining, corded neck when Richards woke up, sweating. -053 and counting. It was no good in Manchester anymore. He didn't know if it was the news of Laughlin's brutal Midwestern end, or the dream, or only a premonition. But on Tuesday morning he stayed in, not going to the library. It seemed to him that every minute he stayed in this place was an invitation to quick doom. Looking out the window, he saw a hunter with a black hood inside every old beaner and slumped taxi driver. Fantasies of gunmen creeping soundlessly up the hall toward his door tormented him. He felt a huge clock was ticking in his head. He passed the point of indecision shortly after 11 o'clock on Tuesday morning. It was impossible to stay. He knew they knew. He got his cane and tapped clumsily to the elevators and went down to the lobby. Going out, Father Grassner? The day clerk asked with his usual pleasant, contemptuous smile. Day off, Richard said, speaking at the day clerk's shoulder. Is there a picture show in this town? He knew there were at least 10, 8 of them showing 3D perverto shows. Well, the clerk said cautiously, there's the center. I think they show Disney's. That will be fine, Richard said briskly and bumped into a potted plant on his way out. 2 blocks from the hotel, he went into a drugstore and bought a huge roll of bandage and a pair of cheap aluminum crutches. The clerk put his purchases in a long fiberboard box, and Richards caught a taxi on the next corner. The car was exactly where it had been, and if there was a stakeout at the U Park, Richards could not spot it. He got in and started up.
He had a bad moment when he realized he lacked a driver's license in any name that wasn't Hot, and then dismissed it. He didn't think his new disguise would get him past close scrutiny anyway. If there were roadblocks, he would try to crash them. It would get him killed, but he was going to get killed anyway if they tabbed him. He tossed the Ogden Grasner glasses in the glove box and drove out, waving noncommittally at the boy on duty at the gate. The boy barely looked up from the skin magazine he was reading. He stopped for a full compressed air charge on the high-speed urban sprawl on the northern outskirts of the city. The air jockey was in the midst of a volcanic eruption of acne and seemed pathetically anxious to avoid looking at Richards. So far, so good. He switched from 91 to Route 17, and from there to a blacktop road with no name or number. 3 miles farther along, he pulled onto a rutted dirt turnaround and killed the engine. Tilting the rearview mirror to the right angle, he wrapped the bandage around his skull as quickly as he could, holding the end and clipping it. A bird twittered restlessly in a tired-looking elm. Not too bad. If he got breathing time in Portland, he could add a neck brace. He put the crutches beside him on the seat and started the car. 40 minutes later, he was entering the traffic circle at Portsmouth. Headed up Route 95, he reached into his pocket and pulled out the crumpled piece of ruled paper that Bradley had left him. He had written on it, in the careful script of the self-educated, using a soft lead pencil. 94 State Street, Portland. The Blue Door. Guests. Elton Paracus and Virginia Paracus. Richards frowned at it a moment, then glanced up. A black and yellow police unit was cruising slowly above the traffic on the turnpike, in tandem with a heavy ground unit below. They bracketed him for a moment, and then were gone, zigzagging across the 6 lanes in a graceful ballet. Routine traffic patrol. As the miles passed, a queasy, almost reluctant sense of relief formed in his chest. It made him feel like laughing and throwing up at the same time. Minus 052 and counting. The drive to Portland was without incident. But by the time he reached the edge of the city, driving through the built-up suburbs of Scarborough, rich homes, rich streets, rich private schools surrounded by electrified fences, the sense of relief had begun to fade again. They could be anywhere. They could be all around him, or they could be nowhere. State Street was an area of blasted ancient brownstones not far from an overgrown jungle-like park. A hangout, Richards thought, for this small city's muggers, lovers, hypes, and thieves. No one would venture out on State Street after dark without a police dog on a leash or a score of fellow gang members. Number 94 was a crumbling, soot-encrusted building with ancient green shades pulled down over its windows. To Richards, the house looked like a very old man who had died with cataracts in his eyes. He pulled to the curb and got out. The street was dotted with abandoned air cars, some of them rusted down to almost formless hulks. On the edge of the park, a Studebaker lay on its side like a dead dog. This was not police country, obviously. If you left your car unattended, it would gain a clot of leaning, spitting, slate-eyed boys in 15 minutes. In half an hour, some of the leaning boys would have produced crowbars and wrenches and screwdrivers. They would tap them, compare them, twirl them, have mock sword fights with them. They would hold them up into the air thoughtfully, as if testing the weather or receiving mysterious radio transmission through them. In an hour, the car would be a stripped carcass, from air caps and cylinders to the steering wheel itself. A small boy ran up to Richards as he was setting his crutches under himself. Puckered, shiny burn scars had turned one side of the boy's face into a hairless Frankenstein horror. "Skag, mister? Good stuff. Put you on the moon." He giggled secretly, the lumped and knobbed flesh of his burnt face bobbing and writhing grotesquely. "Fuck off," Richards said briefly. The boy tried to kick one of his crutches out from under him, and Richards swung one of them in a low arc, swatting the boy's bottom. He ran off, cursing. He made his way up the pitted stone steps slowly and looked at the door. It had once been blue, but now the paint had faded and peeled to a tired desert sky color. There had once been a doorbell, but some vandal had taken care of that with a cold chisel. Richards knocked and waited. Nothing. He knocked again. It was late afternoon now, and cold was creeping slowly up the street. Faintly, from the park beyond the end of the block, came the bitter clacking of October branches losing their leaves. There was no one here. It was time to go. Yet he knocked again, curiously convinced that there was someone in there.
And this time he was rewarded with the slow shuffling of house slippers. A pause at the door. Then, "Who's out there? I don't buy nothing. Go away." "I was told to visit you," Richard said. A peephole swung open with a minute squeak, and a brown eye peeked through. Then the peephole closed with a snap. "I don't know you." Flat dismissal. "I was told to ask for Elton Paracus." Grudgingly. "Oh, you're one of those." Behind the door, locks began to turn. Bolts began to be unbolted one by one. Chains dropped. There was the click of revolving tumblers in one Yale lock and then another. The chunk slap of the heavy-duty trap bolt being withdrawn. The door swung open, and Richards looked at a scrawny woman with no breasts and huge knotted hands. Her face was unlined, almost cherubic, but it looked as if it had taken hundreds of invisible hooks and jabs and uppercuts in a no-holds-barred brawl with time itself. Perhaps time was winning, but she was not an easy bleeder. She was almost 6 feet tall, even in her flat, splayed slippers, and her knees were swollen into tree stumps with arthritis. Her hair was wrapped in a bath turban. Her brown eyes, staring at him from under a deep ledge of brow, the eyebrows themselves clung to the precipice like desperate mountain bushes, struggling against the aridity and the altitude, were intelligent and wild with what might have been fear or fury. Later he understood she was simply muddled, afraid, tottering on the edge of insanity. "I'm Virginia Paracus," she said flatly. "I'm Elton's mother. Come in." -051 and counting. She did not recognize him until she had led him into the kitchen to brew tea. The house was old and crumbling and dark, furnished in a decor he recognized immediately from his own environment, modern junk shop. "Elton isn't here now," she said, brooding over the battered aluminum teapot on the gas ring. The light was stronger here, revealing the brown water stains that blotched the wallpaper, the dead flies, souvenirs of summer past, on the windowsills, the old linoleum creased with black lines, the pile of wet wrapping paper under the leaking drain pipe. There was an odor of disinfectant that made Richards think of last nights in sick rooms. She crossed the room, and her swollen fingers made a painful search through the heaped junk on the countertop, until they found two tea bags, one of them previously used. Richards got the used one. He was not surprised. "He works," she said, faintly accentuating the first word and making the statement an accusation. "You're from that fellow in Boston, the one Elfie writes to about pollution, ain't you?" "Yes, Mrs. Paracus." "They met in Boston. My Elton services automatic vending machines." She preened for a moment and then began her slow trek back across the dunes of linoleum to the stove. "I told Elfie that what that Bradley was doing was against the law. I told him it would mean prison, or even worse. He doesn't listen to me, not to his old mom, he doesn't." She smiled with dark sweetness at this calumny. "Elton was always building things, you know. He built a tree house with four rooms out back when he was a boy. That was before they cut the elm down, you know. But it was that darkie's idea that he should build a pollution station in Portland." She popped the bags into cups and stood with her back to Richards, slowly warming her hands over the gas ring. "They write each other. I told him the mails aren't safe. You'll go to prison or even worse," I said. He said, "But Mom, we do it in code. He asks for a dozen apples. I tell him my uncle is a little worse." I said, "Elsie, do you think they can't figure that secret spy stuff out?" "He doesn't listen." "Oh, he used to. I used to be his best friend. But things have changed. Since he got to puberty, things have changed. Dirty magazines under his bed and all that business. Now this darkie. I suppose they caught you testing smogs or carcinogens or something, and now you're on the run." It don't matter," she said fiercely at the window. It looked out on a backyard filled with rusting pieces of junk and tire rims and some little boy's sandbox that now, many years later, was filled with scruffy October woods. "It don't matter," she repeated. "It's the darkies." She turned to Richards, and her eyes were hooded and furious and bewildered. "I'm 65, but I was only a fresh young girl of 19 when it began to happen. It was 1979, and the darkies were everywhere, everywhere. Yes, they were," she nearly screamed, as if Richards had taken issue with her.
Everywhere. They sent those darkies to school with the whites. They set them high in the government. Radicals, rabble-rousing, and rebellion. I ain't so...
She broke off as if the words had been splintered from her mouth. She stared at Richards, seeing him for the first time.
Oh, God have mercy, she whispered.
Mrs. Farragut.
Nope,
she said in a fear-hoarsened voice.
Nope, nope, oh, nope.
She began advancing on him, pausing at the counter to pick up a long, gleaming butcher knife out of the general clutter.
Out, out, out!
He got up and began to back away slowly, first through the short hall between the kitchen and shadowy living room, then through the living room itself. He noticed that an ancient pay telephone hung on the wall from the days when this had been a bona fide inn. The Blue Door. Guests. When was that? Richards wondered. 20 years ago? 40? Before the darkies had gotten out of hand, or after? He was just beginning to back down the hall between the living room and the front door when a key rattled in the lock. They both froze as if some celestial hand had stopped the film while deciding what to do next. The door opened, and Elton Farragut walked in. He was immensely fat, and his lackluster blonde hair was combed back in preposterous waves from his forehead to show a round baby face that held an element of perpetual puzzlement. He was wearing the blue and gold uniform of the Vendo Spendo Company. He looked thoughtfully at Virginia Farragut. End of side 19. To continue, turn the cassette over.